For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome. My name is Paula Lazarz. I'm one of the ordained priests here at Ancient Dragon, studying under my teacher, Teigen Dan Leighton. I think that's all I want to say about myself. Teigen asked me to give the talk today, and I really appreciate the opportunity to do this. I know some of you are here, I think, for the first time. Welcome. I came to Buddhist practice to eliminate my own personal suffering. So, and then it kind of grows into something maybe a bit more than that. But oftentimes if I'm asked to give a talk, and there's so many different topics within the topic of Buddhism, and so many in the topic of Zen Buddhism, that I often come back to what brought me to practice to try and figure out what to talk about. In Zen Buddhism, we have a saying that we go beyond words and letters. So oftentimes, it could be a real challenge to put words or conceptions on things that are very experiential. And oftentimes, Buddhist teachings can feel very esoteric, very abstract, for this very reason. But when I'm asked to give the talk lately, I've been trying to talk about things that are more difficult to talk about, to kind of challenge myself and to also see with my experience, with my Zazen, if maybe there is some way I could find the words to talk about these things. So with that preamble done, I'd like to talk about dependent co-arising and the end of suffering. Very humble thing to talk about, very simple. It is said that the Buddha's enlightenment came forth because when he sat for 6 years, eventually the wisdom grew in him where he understood the causes and conditions that form the basis for our suffering. And when he was able to understand the causes and conditions that bring forth our suffering, he became enlightened. And then from that point, he was able to develop a teaching method to help us, other beings, not only humans, but other beings, to eliminate their suffering. This philosophy is often called or translated as dependent co-arising. In Sanskrit, it's paticca samuppada. Sometimes it's translated as 12 causes and conditions. Sometimes it's translated as the law of dependent origination. Sometimes as interdependent co-arising. And sometimes just as the wheel of Dharma. So many of you who either have dabbled in Buddhism or are long-term practitioners have heard one of these terms, if not all of these terms. Alex, can you put the clock where I like facing me? Thank you. Okay. The Buddha put it succinctly as, if this exists, that exists. If this ceases to exist, that also ceases to exist. For our purposes, since we are human beings and we do see things in a perceptual, conceptual way, our consciousness creates structure for our experience. Oftentimes, these 12 links are broken down into these factors: ignorance, intentional formations, consciousness, mind-body, senses, contact, feeling, craving, grasping, becoming, birth, and then aging and death. Now, even though they've just been spoken of in a linear fashion, one of the hardest things to understand about our practice, our zazen, this Buddhist philosophy, is nothing's really happening in a linear fashion. Everything's happening in a circular fashion, for lack of a better word, and everything's actually happening all at the same time. So for our perceptual understanding, we put these out as such, but in actuality, it's an ongoing process constantly happening in a circular fashion. Now, oftentimes, it's helpful, not so much in Zen practice. In Zen practice, we talk about interdependence. We talk about relationship when we talk about dependent co-arising. In other lineages at times, pictures are kind of presented so we can grasp what these concepts mean. So I'm going to present Tibetan pictures for each one that sometimes could help us understand what's going on here. Ignorance is often depicted as a blind woman and often just described as not knowing the Dharma, which means not knowing the teachings, not knowing the truth, not knowing what the Buddha taught. Intentional formations is often of a potter working with clay. Meaning lack of knowledge gives rise to all kinds of actions. Now, when we see a potter working with clay, right away we think there's a person involved. But really, the action that we're focused on is that wheel of clay turning, and it could be really shaped into any kind of formation at this point. But there's really no being or anything involved at this point. Consciousness is often depicted as a monkey going from window to window. And this, again, there's not necessarily one vantage point happening here. It's just volition kind of looking all over the place on how it might experience itself. So often we could say, too, it's the first seed of life. It's the first seed of something happening. Mind-body, often depicted as people sitting in a boat with one person steering. And this is when a life or an event or a happenstance starts to take shape. It's still not an actual human being or being or event yet. The next one, the senses, often depicted as a house with six windows and a door. We have five perceptual senses, you know, eyes, ears, tactile sense. We know these. And then the mind is considered the sixth sense. So now we're talking about, for example, the senses developing in an embryo, or an embryo being a picture of any kind of thing starting to take shape. It doesn't necessarily have to be a human being. So we want to try and, even though we're looking at specific things, we want to try and keep our thinking about this kind of broad. Contact is often depicted as a couple embracing. So now we have these senses, and they throw themselves out there in a sense, and then something comes back because there was something else out there which the senses kind of formed, said, okay, this is a blah, blah, blah. This is blah, blah, blah. Things start taking shape. Now that things have started to take shape, often called a sense organ and an object, then there's feeling, often pictured as an eye pierced by an arrow. That's such a great way of really having feeling hit home, right? This is the experience of contact, oftentimes said as attraction, aversion, or indifference. Meaning anything that we experience, we usually have these three reactions to it. Attraction, we really like it, we might want more. Aversion, we're pushing away from it. We don't like it. We're definitely sure that we don't want it. We want as little of it as we can possibly have. And indifference, which means we don't care either way, or we're bored with it, or it doesn't even raise a flag in our attention. Next is craving, often depicted as a person drinking beer. And this means that once we experience attraction, aversion, or indifference, then we get attracted to the things that we like. We start to crave the things that we like, and we want more of those things to happen. But they really didn't necessarily, they're not necessarily happening. We're just thinking like we'd really like that to happen. And then after that comes grasping, which is pictured as a monkey reaching for fruit. And you know, this grabbing hand, we all know this, right? Figuratively and emotionally and intellectually, we all know this feeling. And this is craving, reaching for things, and wanting to literally hold on to them so that it never changes. Once you get the thing you like, you don't want it to change. Now, finally, becoming is pictured as a pregnant woman. And this is often talked about as rebirth consciousness. But let's just call it consciousness because, you know, rebirth is a concept in Buddhism. Some people believe it, some people don't. I don't think it's necessary for us to believe in reincarnation for us to kind of explore these concepts. Then birth is a woman giving birth. There is life, life again, or life happening, or something's happening. And then there's, of course, once we are born, there's aging and death. And this goes with birth. Because there is birth, there is aging and death. If there is no birth, there can't be any aging and death. And then after the death, the whole cycle starts again. But again, we want to remember that the cycle is happening all the time. It's happening all the time. It's happening all the time. Now, it's easy to apply this as a singular life starting to get created and going through the womb and coming out into the world, because this is how, as human beings, we see things. And it could be helpful to think of it that way. But then I was playing around with, well, how can we apply this to just circumstances? And I thought of a young person seeking a career, a young person who's just going out into the world. First, the young person as a child is ignorant to all the things they could do with their life. Then they start getting volitional or kind of not desire yet, but there's a sense of locomotion. You know, they start exploring different sports. Maybe there's certain academics in school, but really the parent is trying to put them in everything they can, because even though there's an intention to do something, you know, we know with parents, you have to do something. The child has to do something. They can't just sit there, right? So it's a process of locomotion, starting to explore consciousness. Then the young person starts kind of forming, okay, this is basketball, this is math, this is, okay, all that starts to happen. Mind-body, then the person starts bringing themselves into what they're doing and starts to kind of have a plan themselves about how they want to go about exploring this. Senses, they're bringing their entire self now. They have a plan about how they want to do their all these different things they're exploring. And they know that they have to study, they might have to move, they have to think about it a little bit, they might have to talk to someone else about it. They have very concrete experiences of doing it. Contact, exploring it even further, doing it with other people who are like-minded. Feeling, how do you feel about it when you start exploring it with like-minded people? Some of them you like, some of them you don't. Some tell you to do it this way, some tell you to do it that way. You have different emotions around that. Then you crave the ones that seem easier. Oftentimes when things get difficult, you say, this isn't for me, I'm going the other way, right? Grasping, then trying to hold on to the easier path of whatever you choose to do with your life. And then you become that. You start living your life, embracing what you feel you should be doing. You give birth to that life, and then eventually you live it, and then you start to slow down as the natural process of aging and death happens, and then eventually you're gone. So this was one way to apply it to just an event or a happenstance. And I'm bringing this up for a reason, because really we could apply this to anything that goes on in our realm of influence, in our sphere, in our world. We could apply it to the world. We could apply it to events. We could apply it to our singular life. It doesn't only have to be just us. But we know our suffering stems from us, from the idea of our individuality. It's said the Buddha contemplated this theory of causes and conditions from the reverse. So he started from aging and death and worked his way backwards. And that's how he became enlightened. I'm just throwing that out there for those of you who like this kind of thing. But now, concretely, we know that our suffering really arises because it's hard to fathom that we are a fluid being. We don't believe it. We believe that we're solid and we're fixed. And then because of that, it's hard for us to acknowledge that someday we will cease to exist. So even though we know we're going to die, we don't really believe that when we first learn the concept of it, because we believe we are a singular being. We suffer because we believe we exist in a type of vacuum and things happen to us. And that stems from us feeling we have a singular vantage point. So here we are, here's the world, and the world is just kind of throwing a bunch of stuff at us, and we're either blocking or grabbing it or doing something, but we're kind of a fixed point. We suffer because we believe we have control over maintaining a state of comfort at all times. We all know that one well enough, right? We all like to be comfortable, of course. The problem is that when things happen and we're not comfortable anymore, we have a hard time embracing that. So we really suffer. We suffer because we want a singular perspective. And we know this in the times we live in. People don't all think the same right now. It's very clear. There are schisms, and we really suffer when that happens. And we want everybody to kind of be on the same page. And we really want that really bad. And we suffer very much. It's amazing, even if you're not directly around people who think differently than you, how much suffering they could cause you, right? Personally. A lot of anxiety. And, of course, the great constant. We suffer because we just can't accept that we age, get sick, and die. Even though we could say that we do, but we don't really. Come on. I mean, let's be honest with ourselves. It's hard to kind of swallow that. So if we know this dependent co-arising, when pleasant things arise, we practice with trying not to cling and grasp. That is our practice. When unpleasant things arise, we practice by not condemning, judging, pushing away. And when things arise that we're not excited about and we could care less about, we try not to be forgetful. We try to be fully present, even though we don't really care one way or another about them. We try to bring all of our attention to it. The Buddha said that the way of forgetfulness is the way of death. So our individual practice starts here. And where does it start? It starts on our meditation cushion. When we're practicing zazen, we're facing the wall. Even though we bring the entirety of our experience and everything else with us when we sit down, this is where we're turning the light within and we're trying to figure out what's going on with us. And then oftentimes, we could look at our suffering, we could look at what's causing us discomfort or pleasure, but if we have a hard time dealing with it, we can be fully present and we could also practice compassion with ourselves. Because we understand codependent arising, we could say, oh, you know, I'm suffering. I feel for myself because it's difficult for myself to accept this. But I understand there are causes and conditions that brought me here. So here's where we start to practice compassion. We start practicing it with ourselves when we feel we're having difficulty with something. And then from there, to bring our practice further out, then we could practice with our community. When there are things out in the world that are bringing suffering to others, we practice compassion then because we're familiar with it, because we practice compassion with ourselves. And then whatever's happening in the world, we could say, that person, their viewpoint, stems from their own causes and conditions. It stems from their own suffering. And I understand that because I'm here in this experience because I have my own causes and conditions that resulted in where I'm at. And hopefully we can meet each other within that circular happening of all these things going on in some fashion. If there are all these causes and conditionings happening at the same time, though, how can we expect an outcome when we're trying to do something? So if we have an idea of creating change in the world, it's very important that it comes from our intention but not from a goal setting. Because we really don't know, when we put an intention out in the world, we really don't know what the result of it's going to be. And I think for me, this is where faith comes in. Because if our practice is sound and it relieves our suffering, we have to have faith that when we bring good intention out into the world, there is going to be change. There is going to be the cessation of suffering. But we have to acknowledge we don't necessarily know how that is going to manifest. If we can't acknowledge that, we're just creating more suffering for ourselves and possibly for the other people around us or the other beings or the environment. Tigan's teacher is Reb Anderson, and I pulled this out of a book he wrote called Being Upright about dependent co-arising. Dependent co-arising explains how suffering is born and points to the way that freedom from suffering is realized. By understanding how all things arise together, we shift from viewing ourselves as acting upon and realizing all things to a new vision of seeing all things coming forth and realizing us. When we begin to understand interdependence, we're grateful for everything that happens in our life, because everything that comes to us is the Buddha Dharma. We turn towards the very situation that causes us pain and anxiety with an intention to understand it more deeply, and we immerse ourselves in our present life. Looking at the way we explored these 12 causes and conditions from a singular viewpoint. Now just flip it around and imagine that someone else who is looking at you created you from their causes and conditions. We're creating this room together from our causes and conditions. This room here exists because of what we're creating together. And if we were not creating this together because of the causes and conditions that are happening right now, this room would not exist. So this is pointing to that kind of interdependence. When we say the universe is manifesting us, without all of that perception coming together, we don't exist. Our singular self doesn't exist, even though we're used to looking from one point out. It's also from many points looking in. Zen emphasizes that. Dogen Zenji, who is the Japanese Zen master, who brought this lineage from China to Japan in the mid-1200s, said about interdependence, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. No trace of realization remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. And I think I'll stop there and see if any comments or things have, your causes and conditions have caused it to come up for you. I always do that. Hi.
Thank you, Paula, for that talk. I find that when I come here and sit here, it's so different from when I sit at home. I can sense I'm part of the great silence here, and it's sort of something that we just talked about, I think, toward the end, and then I'm very grateful for it, and I thank you, and I thank the group for letting me be part of it.
Thank you, Miriam. Hey, Bo.
Thank you for your time, Paula. The quote you, what was the context of that comment again?
Indifference. Attraction, aversion, and indifference. Mm-hmm. Meaning?
So forgetting kind of where you are, the context of kind of your being, maybe? Being indifferent to that?
Or being deluded as to the causes and conditions that created this present moment, being completely ignorant of that.
Yeah. It's such a like, powerful saying, and like, it kind of puts you just a reminder to kind of be aware of, you know, like vigilantly kind of attending to those causes and conditions. Yeah. Thank you.
And this is one thing I believe when we look at this, the Buddha talked about is constantly exploring those causes and conditions. And the more we explore them and get familiar with them, that will alleviate our suffering because we'll understand the viewpoint of that suffering better.
And then, you know, the Dogen quote of like studying self is forgetting self. I guess that's where I was kind of like thinking about forgetting. So it's like not forgetting the causes and attending to being rigorous and sort of reminding ourselves of these causes and conditions. And then in some way that attendance, then you forget the self and that's actualizing. There's like two understandings of forgetting there that I'm sort of interested in. But I don't know how to make sense of it exactly. But
I don't either.
I would hear that as forgetting, really studying the self that we forget our particular self, our individual self, as you were saying, and see the wider view, which includes this self. So that's how I would hear that.
We know, too, that in our zazen, we could experience that wider self. But we all know how difficult it is if we do have an experience of that. Once we walk out and get into the routine of our regular lives, we tend to beat ourselves up. If we lose our temper or we get bored or we're not mindful when we're washing our face. You know, so it's not that easy to bring that wider experience throughout the course of each moment. But we practice when we do zazen.
And that's the part that you said about being compassionate to oneself. Giving oneself being a human being.
Getting angry or impatient or forgetting to remember when we're washing our face.
So it's important to get angry and impatient. That's what we see all.
And then we could practice compassion.
Thanks, that was a great talk. Since I love science, it's kind of my field. By science is my field, at least in terms of like quantum physics and how, you know, they say that when you observe something, you change it. And so I think that's, as you know, I was thinking that Buddhism is so aligned in some respects with that. But I guess I just was wondering if you could comment on thinking of it in terms of not just, because just observing something, you could change it, but it's like you have to almost observe it with a certain level of compassion in order to have faith that something, the change will be good versus bad. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I guess, you know, I was just, and so when you were talking about having faith, I was just thinking of that. You know, like you can observe if something might change, but is that change going to be good or potentially bad, depending on how you're observing it?
You know, I always end up bringing my martial arts practice into everything. Sorry. But oftentimes, we need to observe other people doing things. And this is part of my practice, meaning like if someone's testing for their next sash, there's a bunch of people sitting and they're watching the person perform certain moves. And I've learned over time that the quality of that attention matters. And I'm just starting there, okay? So if we're fully present and really watching these people, the experience they have doing the test is very different. And when they feel they've been completely seen, there is a flowering of that individual. And now I get really emotional about it because, you know, we can't control everything that happens. But sometimes when we're testing, like, you can't force everybody to pay that kind of attention to somebody. And so if you have five people sitting on this panel watching the test, but now, mind you, everyone's that's watching this has seen it at least 100 times, if not more, at this point. So, of course, people start talking to each other or they start, you know, drinking water, or they get up and walk away. And if I'm trying to coordinate it, it's really hurtful to me, you know, to the person. But I practice with not trying to control everybody in the room. Okay, that's my practice then, because I can't force them to pay attention to this person, right? So all I'm trying to say is, I know the quality of attention makes a difference. I know this firsthand, but beyond that, I don't know anything else about how that works. And I'm still trying to practice with it myself. Even when it hurts, when someone else isn't paying the kind of attention to an event or a problem or something that I wish they would. So then it's time for me to turn compassion to myself and explore why I'm so hurt about it. And that probably doesn't answer your question at all.
No, it wasn't. Yeah.
Or comments.
It's a great comment. I think that was more than I was interested
in. Thank you.
So you said that there's this thing called causes and conditions, and for causes and effects. And so, for example, in a situation where some actions cause suffering to us, and just like you, I intend to eliminate suffering, and doesn't mean that to eliminate suffering means to eliminate the cause of suffering. Like, that's sort of intuitively makes sense. Yeah, and just what do you say about it? Like, to eliminate the cause of suffering?
Yeah, I was just kind of talking with another Sangha member about this last week. From my practice, I've just accepted that there's suffering in this human realm. And it doesn't mean you ignore it. It means that you do what your heart tells you to do in this world, on how you feel you need to respond to it. But I'm not shocked by the fact that they're suffering. And at this point, I'm not shocked at how horrifying and heartbreaking and stomach-turning and horrific the events that happen in the world are. I think that if you could give that same kind of presence we were talking about, Lisa, to horror as well, you can learn to live with it. And I'm not saying don't do anything, but I'm saying don't be afraid to look at it and don't push it away. Don't push it away, because it's part of our codependent arising. It is. And it's easy to create the other when we're trying to look at it. It's safer. It's less painful. But in order for things to change, we cannot keep creating the other. We have to be in the middle of it all. You know, you're young, and I know you want to believe that you can make it stop. Sometimes young people want things to stop, you know. as far as I understand, that's what Tibetans use to explore the 12 causes and conditions. So I think if you just put 12 causes and conditions Tibetan, you'll probably get something up on it.
Well, it's a very basic Buddhist teaching, the 12-fold chain of causation. It's talking about the 12-fold chain of causation. So basic Buddhist books on basic Buddhist teaching. Buddhist, this is said to be what the Buddha realized. It's a very basic Buddhist teaching.
Yeah, I understand the precepts and some of the other stuff I've read. It's the first time I've heard the 12-fold.
Yeah, it's very basic.
Updated visually?
Yeah.
You know, Tibet visually, like the vision, the images of the plotter and all that stuff, that is really wonderful. You know, one thing that I like to do is draw that out. For yourself, or you know, all the Tibetan wheels of becoming, or many tongas have that imagery, so it's very available.
Yeah, the wheel of causation is not in Tibetan.
You know, in this culture where they have the wheel of walking,
yeah, that's a dharma, that's a turning mantras, actually. But in that wheel of becoming, it's really interesting, right? Because at the center is, what, a pig, a rooster, and something else, snake. So greed, hate, delusion is what that turns everything. I wanted to also thank you for speaking about and elucidating sort of the teachings that all things preach the Dharma. That's following, like, not only is this room, I was feeling, I think when the Miriam was speaking, that, like, this, we're being created by the room. We create the room, but this is creating us. You know, that whatever contact we're having with the floor, the cushion, or each other, through our sight senses, is then creating our experience of the world and us, of this body.
Thank you, Katsu. Oh, my pleasure. Well, I think, do we have to stop? Or could we take one more?
Yeah, there's another comment.
Is there any? Hi, Kathy. Mm-hmm. I think that our practice really helps us be aware of that. And I know even for myself, sometimes if I have what I call a knee-jerk reaction that's negative about something, the Zazen has helped me. I don't hold it back. I never hold it back. I've learned that's not a good thing to do. And I'm not saying that I hurt people, but even if I'm going to swear at somebody, as I'm swearing at them, I'm very aware of what I'm doing. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't happen by accident. I feel it come up, and I've made a choice that I'm going to let it come out because I need it to come out. And then practice compassion with myself that I didn't. It's not about stuffing your emotions. You know, you have to accept that you feel the way you feel. But what do you do with that feeling? What do you do with it? You know, and it's not about trying to be some idea of who you're supposed to be. It's about really embracing who you are in any moment. You know, so I'm just really aware that as all the expletives, because it's never just one, comes out, I'm like very aware of which word I'm going to say next. And then I might have repercussions because of it too, though.
And then there's, you know, an evaluation, yeah, that happens too. It's sometimes I think, oh, that was unreasonable. They didn't have a choice, blah, blah, blah. And sometimes I think, no, that person must have caused an accident and they're doing crazy stuff.
Sometimes somebody's going fast and cutting people off. I think, oh, maybe they're going to the hospital for some reason.
Yeah, justifications.
Maybe.
Could be. Yeah, could be.